Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A couple of musical favorites are with us a little bit later in the program, Emmylou Harris and Steve Earle. They're in town for a good cause, and contributor Steve Potter will explain a little bit later. These two entertainers are likely to draw good crowds when they perform, including a lot of out-of-towners, perhaps. And that's become an increasingly big deal for St. Louis and cities just like it. Tourism is a big industry, and it's not by accident. Cities like St. Louis count on it to make up for post-war economic decline. Our first guest is Aaron Cowan, and he has written about it in his book, A Nice Place to Visit, Tourism and Urban Revitalization in the Post-War Rust Belt. He teaches history at Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania, and he joins us from Slippery Rock. Aaron, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Don. Thank you.
Before we get into specifics about some of the things you're saying and some of the things that you found, give me some sense as to why you got into this particular subject in the first place.
Sure. Well, I was a PhD student at the University of Cincinnati, another river city, much like St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And I remember as I was looking for, you know, my research topic and my interests, and I remember walking around downtown Cincinnati and realizing, besides the office buildings, how much of the central part of the city was really made for people who didn't live there. That there were, you know, big hotels, there was the sports stadiums that often brought in a lot of outsiders, as many as they did locals. The Underground Railroad Freedom Center Museum on the riverfront in that city was just under development. And of course, there was a massive convention center, which takes up a lot of the downtown. And so it got me thinking about, you know, why that was. Why, in the again, the what you think of as the heart of the city, so much of it wasn't really used by locals all the time, maybe with the exception of the sports stadiums. But and got me thinking about, if you know, why that had become that way, had it always been that way, and exploring the kind of role of tourism in cities like Cincinnati and St. Louis and others.
So was there a eureka moment when you figured out what it was that was causing this to happen?
I'm not sure if there was a eureka moment, but I do know that there was what you certainly saw is the growing importance that, in fact, it hadn't always been like that, that tourism was a relatively minor industry that was an afterthought in the first part of the 20th century, and yet by the 1960s, 70s, and certainly today, it's one of the largest industries in the world, and really no city can afford not to have a pretty vibrant tourist industry. So, you know, that was a realization that this was a relatively recent phenomenon and was tied into much larger currents of urban history.
So cities had to figure out a way to draw tourists to them, obviously.
That's right. And, you know, that's maybe easy if you're Miami or you're Honolulu, or you're even in some ways Las Vegas or something, you know, even a sort of a strange outlier, really a city that's only about tourism. But how do you get people to want to hold a convention in St. Louis? So how do you get, you know, and particularly the St. Louis of the 1950s or 60s when, you know, a lot of the city was declining, right? And how do you get people to want to take a family vacation to Baltimore or these cities that are that have reputations as dirty and as run down and as places that, in fact, people are leaving, right? You know, the population of these cities declines pretty rapidly after World War II. And so, you know, how do you transform an industrial city into a city friendly to visitors, into a, you know, if I may, a nice place to visit?
Sure. Well, the focus of your book is on Baltimore, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis. Why these four in particular?
Well, I was interested in cities that are roughly of the same size and type. Again, I was interested in that kind of tension between gritty industrial cities and, you know, trying to make them into tourist playgrounds. And so, and I was, you know, rather than just studying one city, I wanted to kind of compare across different places to sort of see what the different experiences are. So, I picked those cities, you know, three good National League cities, one American League baseball towns, and they each, I was interested in St. Louis in particular because, of course, because of the Gateway Arch, which is internationally known. So that was a reference point that I had for tourism in St. Louis and began to examine the story there more deeply.
Not the Cardinals, though, right?
No, as a Cincinnati Reds fan, I have a hard time even writing about the Cardinals. But you know, I respect them, even if it's some bitter feelings sometimes.
Well, you may have double loyalties, being where you are. Or the Pittsburgh Pirates probably also are.
That's true. My children are growing up Pirates fans, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. But.
You used the word a moment ago. You talked about tension, and you write about tensions in tourist development.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? What kind of tension are we talking about?
Sure. Well, so there's a couple of, factors that go into when a city says, okay, we're going to really focus on attracting visitors, right? And that means we need something for them to come see. We need places for them to stay because, of course, if you can get them to stay longer, they'll spend more money. And so we need nice new hotels. Maybe we need a convention center. Maybe we need, a new sports stadium that will draw in people from even outside of our local area. And in doing that, of course, you have to demolish a lot of things in order to build these big new buildings. So in the 1950s, 60s, a lot of that demolition, of course, happened in poorer neighborhoods in the central parts of cities. So there was a lot of tension there about, bulldozing a neighborhood or part of a city to build something that, has no connection to the local community. Then increasingly through, the 50s, 60s, and on, more and more governments, local municipal governments, are subsidizing a lot of these developments. So they are pouring in millions of dollars to offer incentives so that the Hyatt Corporation will come build a hotel in St. Louis or wherever it would be. And this leads, this is at the same time that there are, also declining municipal services that they're able to provide, and cities are financially strapped, and a lot of residents feel like they're not getting the basic necessities of community life, policing and street maintenance and, those sorts of infrastructure, things that we all expect. And so, to many local residents, this, again, is a sort of subsidy for something that doesn't mean anything to them and may not provide the same sort of economic opportunities that they had before.
I guess what you're talking about primarily is TIFs, tax increment financing. St. Louis is certainly using it and has used it a lot. I assume the other cities are doing exactly the same thing.
Sure, yeah. Tax increment financing has been one tool. Before that, there was a good deal of federal money, particularly, again, in the 50s and 60s that went into land clearance and offering to pay the purchase costs so that land could be, using a very developer-friendly eminent domain law. Properties could be purchased up with this kind of federal money that's given to cities. Then they could, move those people out, often isolating those people or putting them into housing projects that were not maintained and that sort of thing. And then building up, a nice new development that makes hotel developers really rich, And so some of those tensions that, are about social class and the real social problems that cities had in the post-war period that seemed out of keeping with building things for white middle-class people to come, play in, basically.
Let's back up for just a moment to be sure that people understand how we got to this point. What caused these four cities? I know the similarity is pretty similar. The pattern is pretty much the same. What caused these cities to go into this post-war decline?
Sure. Well, one of the biggest factors would be suburbanization. You know, I mean, if we think about the 1950s, this is the age of the mass ownership of the automobile and the building of big new highways, the Eisenhower Interstate system, and most importantly, the suburbs. And suburbanization after World War II drew hundreds of thousands of people out of each one of these cities. And with that, you have, of course, a loss, a real decline in the tax base of these cities. And then also industry has been relocating. And so factories and you know, the other manufacturers within these cities are moving to suburban locations, or in some cases they are you know, moving to other countries. And so these cities are, you know, the people still living there don't have access to the same kinds of jobs they had before. And, of course, there's a racial component to this, too, that in the first several decades of the, you know, 20th century after World War II, you had, you know, racial exclusivity, right, the racial discrimination in terms of African Americans were very frequently barred from purchasing homes in suburbs. And so you had a, you know, development where you had the white suburbs and you know, black residents within the actual city itself. And so there's, you know, there's social class divisions and racial divisions, along with the abandonment of these cities by a lot of the major employers that have been there before.
This was a relatively gradual process, as I remember it's happening. When did the leaders in these cities that you're talking about and others realize, at what point did they realize they had a real problem and had to find something to make up for these losses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it varies depending upon the place, but I mean, it really by the late 1940s and into the 50s, all of these cities actually peak in their 20th century population in 1950, and then you see a very sharp decline by 1960. And so, you know, and many of these leaders who have their finger on the pulse of what's happening in industry, what's happening in, you know, retailing and all these sorts of things, they can see it coming even earlier than your average, you know, resident of the cities. And so they begin making plans pretty early to try to prop up property values in the downtowns of these cities and to try to shift the economy away from what in many cases was old, you know, an economy based on railroad shipping or manufacturing, and to try to shift that into other industries, including tourism.
Did that tourism idea just kind of happen? Did it evolve? Everybody seemed to get on the same page at about the same time.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of things that happen in the 50s, one of them being jet air travel. So by the 50s, if you've got a decent-sized airport with a runway long enough to accept, you know, jets when they land, then you can, you know, you can become a convention city, right? And mm-hmm. So early on, a lot of cities begin to push for, let's build a big convention center. And, you know, they think about this as a kind of magnet, right, that will just pull in the dollars from other places, right? And they think about this as it's also it's a industry that if you build the facilities, it can't relocate, right? this is Alfonso Cervantes, mayor of St. Louis in the late 60s and early 70s, gave a talk once in which he said this is, he called tourism the smokeless industry that cannot move to the suburbs. And so it was, you know, the city itself, the location, the central city itself would be that that industry, right? You know, provide those facilities, and then it becomes more complex from there. But that's the basic idea: is we're bulldozing these old parts of the city. We need to remake them as new parts. What industry is going to replace that? And tourism comes to be one of the most attractive.
Well, you mentioned Cervantes. I have to take a break, but you mentioned Cervantes. He tried a couple of stunts that didn't work out too well, but still put St. Louis on the map, I guess, in one respect or another.
Sure.
I'm speaking with Aaron Cowan, who is the author of A Nice Place to Visit, Tourism and Urban Revitalization in the Postwar Rust Belt. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Aaron Cowan, the author of A Nice Place to Visit, Tourism and Urban Revitalization in the Postwar Rust Belt. Aaron, the four cities that we're focusing on in your book, you focused on Baltimore, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis, all go about it in the same way. You mentioned convention centers. We've already mentioned sports complexes. I know all of these cities have those things. Other things as well?
Sure, and a lot of the focus is on hotel development, and so there's this real surge of downtown hotel building in the post-war period, and then in the latter part of the book, I look at I use Baltimore's Inner Harbor redevelopment to typify what by the 70s is a shift, really, where cities begin to try to use some of their historic fabric and some of the unique characteristics about their actual location to draw in tourists, right? And so, if you looked at Baltimore and its Inner Harbor in the 1950s or 60s, you would think this is the last place we ever want visitors to see. You know, it was dirty. It was an industrial port that was no longer heavily used. It was heavily polluted. But it becomes the, you know, once it's redeveloped, it becomes this kind of focal point, and draws visitors in who are sort of drawn to the history of the waterfront and the kind of character there. And so, I look a bit at historically themed development in the later period in the 70s and 80s too.
Boy, I can certainly attest to what you just said about Baltimore. I worked there in 1959, and it was awful. It was absolutely awful. It was one of the most grim places I could ever imagine on the planet.
Sure, yeah, and it's one of the things that's ironic about St. Louis is, of course, again, everyone knows the Gateway Arch, but what was there before the arch, right? That's the question a lot of people don't ask, and in fact, what was bulldozed to build the arch was something that would probably be thought of as a tremendous asset today. It was a really fantastic collection of 19th century architecture would have been a really amazing historic district. And again, today that would be something I think cities would market as an asset. But in the 60s and 50s and 60s, it was thought of as embarrassing, almost, that it was shabby and dirty and, you know, dilapidated. Let's get rid of it and build this, you know, fancy new monument.
Well, as a matter of fact, we've talked about that on this program on a number of occasions.
Sure.
And believe me, there are historians and preservationists who are still weeping over the loss of those historic buildings downtown.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Is there any one of these cities that is doing it better than the other? And if so, how?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways they made these cities tended to make some of the same mistakes as they were going along. But I think the cities where tourism seems to be working better are those where it's not the only or the primary sector of the economy. That it's one of multiple different sectors. So Pittsburgh, for example. Was pretty active early on, pretty intentional about developing universities and developing healthcare and technology as the economy that would replace steel. So I think that in those cases where there's not an over reliance on tourism to sort of fix everything, then those cities have done okay. And I think St. Louis' story is pretty similar in some ways as well. That but I think the problem was in many cases that early on these urban leaders really thought that, if you build it, they will come and this will be the sort of panacea that will solve all of our economic and social woes. And they certainly talked about it that way, and it very rarely delivered on those kind of promises.
What about false starts? And I'm thinking in particular of St. Louis, and you mentioned Mayor Cervantes before, and we had the Santa Maria, a replica of the Columbus vessel down on the riverfront for a while until it kind of blew away. And then we had the Spanish Pavilion, which he brought in from the 1964 World's Fair, as I recall, and that that just kind of stalled in its tracks. Other cities have the same kinds of problems?
They did. Yeah, they did. And you can see a lot of this trial and error and, you know, what can we get? And I have a friend who's also an urban historian who's fond of saying that in the 60s and 70s in these cities, you were holding things together with duct tape and bubble gum. I mean, you were really trying to solve major problems with very limited budgets and resources. And, you know, so I see things like the Santa Maria and the Spanish Pavilion as these kind of small efforts that will try to generate something. But, you know, there are, you know, Baltimore, for example, well, long after most cities had convention centers established, had never sort of gotten its act together to do that. And, it, you know, so there are, you know, there are successes and failures along the way. I think it, but, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm not particularly critical of a lot of those mistakes because, you know, I think urban leaders in the 50s, 60s and on were really thrown for a loop. They were not in many ways prepared for the depth of the problems that they had to face.
I'd like to get some of our listeners into the conversation. We have a couple of calls. 382-8255 is our number, folks, if you'd like to get in. We have a few minutes left. Let's take a call from Mike, who's calling from St. Louis. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air with Aaron Cowan.
Hi. I forgot I didn't get your name of your guest, but most people don't ever bring up what I think is the real ultimate consequence of the deterioration of the cities, and that's our tax code, which back in the 40s and 50s and 60s was 90% for the high end. So if your tax accountant would probably advise you to buy some four families in the city and rent it out. So the owners of these absentee owners had no real interest in the properties except for the tax deduction. And meanwhile, they get subsidy for their new house out in the suburbs, plus all the new roads and all the subsidies that go to the urban expansion. And so any program you might try in the inner city would fail against the pressure of that basic fundamental tax inequity.
Mike, thanks for the call. Let's have Aaron respond to that.
Oh, I think that's definitely an accurate statement that when I speak about land clearance in the 50s and 60s, many of the people who are displaced by, you know, tearing down rows of apartment buildings or whatever, those people don't own those buildings. You know, they're sort of, you know, told to relocate and initially weren't even given any expenses to do, you know, coverage for expenses. And then the people that got the money were these absentee landlords. So, yeah, in a lot of ways, it's a process that leaves renters and working class people very much as victims.
And you mentioned the importance of building themes around history. When historic tax preservation credits were lost, that had to have an impact as well.
Right, yeah, and I think that, you know, historic preservation, the tax credits have really helped with preservation in general, and, you know, this is a debate that goes back and forth about what that, how that should be used. But, yeah, it's, again, a very complex process.
We have another caller. Let's bring in Dick. This would be Dick Fleming, who is well known to our audience here. Dick, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good to be with you, Don and Aaron. First of all, growing up in Baltimore and working for the Rouse Company on Faneuil Hall, I very much agree with what Aaron was talking about in terms of Harbor Place's role. The point that that I would offer, while I think our CVC does a terrific job in the product they have, we had an opportunity several years ago, Don will remember, to raise the bar a couple of notches with a project called Aerotropolis, which most people thought of as just a cargo hub for China, for the United States. But the trailing issue there was the Chinese airlines, commercial airlines, were going to hub here and connect through the country to Southwest. And now that we, through our governor and our rural members of the legislature at the time who killed the project, Atlanta and Denver, two other cities in which I lived, have picked up Aerotropolis and have successfully built it. And it's, in retrospect, given the kind of methodology that Aaron has pointed out of how important this industry is, it would be great to have that increased air service by virtue of being a hub for international airlines.
Dick, thanks for the call.
No, thank you.
Any thoughts about that, Aaron?
Well, I'm not that familiar with the Aerotropolis project, but, you know, I will say, again, it illustrates this competition that goes on between cities, both in the period I'm looking at and today, that, frankly, St. Louis is seeing this now that your football team is playing in Los Angeles, right, that there's in some ways a zero-sum game in which cities are grasping for these these programs or developments or whatever that will boost the economy. But so it's a very fierce competition.
You brought up this kind of takes us somewhat off in a different direction, but I do want to get you to comment on it. One of the things you point out in your book is the fact that developing these tourist attractions also provides a target for people who want to demonstrate or protest and what have you. You mentioned boycotts and that sort of thing. It's a rich target for these folks, isn't it?
It is. It is. And you saw that the story I tell about the convention center in St. Louis and the process there really exposed, I think, a lot of the frustration and anger of working class people in Cincinnati, and particularly African Americans in the working class who did not vote, overwhelmingly did not vote for the convention center bond issue. And also, here's the importance of geography to think about, Cole Street, which borders the convention center, and it's sort of a dividing line between the downtown and North St. Louis. And people at the time saw that. They saw, you know, they said, we're afraid they're going to build this convention center down here, and then the housing projects are going to be torn down. Our neighborhoods are going to be torn down again. And so, again, that's one of those stories where the tensions are very, very clear in the process.
We've only got about a minute and a half left. I guess the $64 question is this working? Is it working for these cities? Are they able to have they reestablished themselves and made up for the losses in industry and corporate losses?
Well, none of them have reached their mid-century peak, but I would say that's unrealistic to expect that they ever would. I would say, does tourism work? Yes and no. I think it provided a sort of transition economy from industry into the service economy. At the same time, again, you have to have a more diverse economy to supplement it, right? The last thing I would say is that the most successful tourist developments in these cities are ones that also provide real benefits and community assets for local people. That any time that you build, and this is one of the reasons that a lot of people have criticized casino development, because this is a form of tourist development that is completely isolated from the local community often. But those tourist developments that are also providing something for locals seem to be the most successful and most helpful to cities.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Aaron Cowan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it, Don.
He is the author of A Nice Place to Visit, Tourism and Urban Revitalization in the Post-War Rust Belt. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.